it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate, and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. The first debate between the ruling corporate parties has now come and gone, with even the mainstream media agreeing that the entire event was a raging dumpster fire. Trump, who has for months said that he will not accept any other outcome in the upcoming election other than a victory, has been prepping his base with tales of impending mass voter fraud through mail-in voting. Trump's allies, such as Roger Stone, have likewise pushed for Trump to declare martial law and make the election void, setting in motion Trump declaring himself the supreme ruler. According to The Atlantic, Trump and Republicans are pushing to install loyal electors within key swing states in order to bypass the popular vote and the Electoral College, which it seems Trump is giving up any hopes of winning. The Trump campaign has also called on its supporters to form an army to guard the polls. Already, Trump supporters have shown up to polling places in an attempt to intimidate voters. During the debates, Trump has even refused to disavow white supremacy and said that the Proud Boys should, quote, stand down, yet, quote, stand by. In the face of this, the neoliberal center is simply pushing for people to come out to the polls in mass numbers and hope for the best, while Trump is openly calling for a coup as the fascist far right pushes for open civil war. With all this in mind, on this episode of the It's Going Down podcast, we discuss what everyday people can expect to play out on election day and how people could possibly mobilize in the face of this disaster to stop the formation of both a Trump dictatorship and a far right wave of violence. Thanks for listening. Let's get into it.
This whole conversation and what sort of motivated doing an episode really focused on what is a single story, right? Really comes down to what was in this story and in the analysis and who wrote it. Why that's relevant and what the implications of this are. And so the story that we're referencing is a story that was written by Barton Gellman, right, who is a journalist who wrote for the Washington Post for about 20 years. He's sort of not writing for any specific outlet anymore. He's kind of freelancing and sort of writing for different outlets now. But he wrote an article for The Atlantic, which I'm sure a lot of people have seen. And the title is something like The Election That Broke America. Right. And it's voluminous. It's very long. It's thousands of words. But just for some background on Gellman himself, Barton Gellman, like I said, wrote for The Washington Post for a really long time. And specifically, his focus was analysis of the intelligence community. He was one of the first people that got documents from Edward Snowden. He was one of the first people that wrote stories about the Snowden leaks. Right. And Gellman is a very well-respected journalist in the world of intelligence analysis, which is really difficult because, I mean, as we've seen, even with some people that write for The Intercept, and this is not everybody by all means, right? There's plenty of amazing journalists that write for The Intercept, like Jeremy Scahill, Natasha Lenard, or people like that. But there's definitely even a tendency at The Intercept for some people to veer a little bit into conspiracy theory, right? And the intelligence analysis world is full of wingnuts, as I'm sure a lot of people could imagine, right? It's full of conspiracy theorists. So for some to be taken really seriously, there's only really a few people that are. And Barton Gellman's one of them. James Bamford's another one. I mean, there's like a handful of people that are really well respected in that world. And so Gelman is one of these people, and he has these deep, deep, deep connections within the Beltway of DC. He's not a person that's prone to alarmism. He's not a person that's prone to writing things based on ideology, although he definitely skews a bit to the left. He's a person that is widely known for giving coherent analysis about really complicated, scary, dangerous things. And so this article runs through Republican strategy around the election. And part of what he's drawing from is he's drawing from other journalists' work, right? So we've been hearing other journalists for months talk about Republican attempts to suppress votes, or the Trump campaign suing states over universal mail-in voting, or the literal constant drone of Donald Trump trying to delegitimize the electoral process, right? By saying it's going to be a fraud and blah, 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 refusing to commit to peaceful transition of power, refusing to acknowledge the results of the election. We've seen a lot of moves that have been made in directions that are very concerning, right? Especially when it came to things like the post office. But what Gelman's laying out is partially sourced from this other work, and it's partially sourced from contacts he has. And it lays out sort of a three-phase strategy, which to understand how this strategy would work really requires a bit of a background on the Electoral College. So for those of you that are not in the United States, buckle in, because the Electoral College is real weird. For people that do live in the United States, the Electoral College is still really strange. But essentially, the Electoral College is a system in which within a state, people vote for a candidate for president, right? Or a slate, a president and vice presidential candidate. In theory, within that state, there are two different groups of electors that are chosen by the opposing political parties, one of which is a group of electors for Democrats, one of which is a group of electors for Republicans. Of course, like the Libertarian Party and the Green Party and stuff also choose slates of electors, but nobody really cares. And when a party wins the popular vote in a state, their electors are supposed to go to the Electoral College to vote for their candidate. Right. It's a really weird system of sort of removed representationalism. But it is how things work. And in every single state but two, those two being Nebraska and Maine, it's a winner take all system. So whichever candidate wins the majority or the plurality, not necessarily majority, but the plurality of votes, in theory, wins that state. Now, in the Electoral College, though, there is nothing which says that electors have to be, quote, loyal. So what that means is that an elector can be sent to the Electoral College and vote against the will of the popular vote in their state. Now, that happens very rarely. I think it's only happened a handful of times in American history, but it is legal to do that. There was a lot of discussion in 2016 about Republican electors deciding not to vote for Donald Trump, and I think one or two actually did refuse to vote for him. But at the same time, those electors, the decision around who wins the election, the validation of a state election in most states, including most swing states, happens on the level of state legislature. So the state legislature goes, okay, cool, we validate that this election was legitimate, and therefore this slate of people gets to go to the Electoral College, right? And of course, it's done in concert with the State Board of Elections and so on and so on. Now, there's a number of things that are going on here that allow this sort of scenario to play out, the scenario that we're going to describe, one of which is that many of the swing states, including Pennsylvania and increasingly states like Ohio and Wisconsin, have state legislatures that are controlled by Republicans, even by pretty wide margins, actually, even though the state itself is sort of kind of in the middle as far as total electoral political support goes. And the reason that that's happened is that Republicans all around the United States have taken to really extreme forms of gerrymandering so they can lose the sort of aggregate popular vote in any sort of state legislature election and still get more seats, right? This also happens federally, where Republicans have lost the popular vote for the House and the Senate and the White House, for like the last four elections or something like that. And yet they still somehow control the Senate, and before that controlled the House. And a lot of that has to do with gerrymandering. So, so there's that in play. The other thing that's in play, which Gelman mentions, is what was called the consent decree. So I'm sure a lot of us have heard about consent decrees, in relation to police departments, where police departments come to an agreement with the Department of Justice to say, quote, reform the police department, in exchange for, you know, DOJ funding and, you know, still being able to participate in programs by military equipment and all these other things. So I think it was 25 years ago, maybe, the Republican Party had to enter into a consent decree with the Department of Justice. And that consent decree was based on systematic voter suppression, which happened in a large amount of states in the 1990s and 80s and 90s. And that voter suppression involved things like sending people to polling places to intimidate people, in some places using police and sheriffs to intimidate people, sending out misinformation about where polling places were. I mean, just like real shady, underhanded tactics. And the Department of Justice and the Federal Board of Elections decided that that was a violation of, you know, every election law in the United States, including the Voting Rights Act, and essentially placed the Republican Party under a consent decree and said that for a certain amount of years, you are not to, you're not allowed to engage in these sort of tactics of voter suppression. And you're not allowed to, say, have monitors go out to polling places and things like this. Right. Now that consent decree is over, and that that consent decree ended after the last midterm election, meaning that now the Republican Party can do all of the things that it did in the past. And it's not like the Department of Justice as it stands is going to stand in the way of that. Right. So they're able to now engage in intimidation tactics that they haven't been able to use in, you know, 25, 30 years. So all of that is in play. So what Gelman is arguing here, and he's using direct sources for all of this, is that there's sort of a three-phase strategy that's getting implemented by Republicans, or at least being talked about all over the country. And we can see some elements of this already being talked about in the open in states like Pennsylvania and Florida. So the first part of this strategy is to send, quote, polling monitors into Democratic-heavy areas and swing states. Now, Trump has said he's going to send police and sheriffs and, you know, U.S. attorneys and stuff to polling places as well to, quote, challenge people. But the campaign has very directly been reaching out into their support base to recruit 50,000 of these, quote, polling monitors. Now, just earlier this week in Virginia, when Virginia opened up its polling places, which it opened them up very early, there were already instances in which Trump supporters were blocking entrances to polling places, intimidating people, shoving people, things like this. So we've already seen this happen. What they're claiming that they're going to do is that they're going to organize 50,000 people to come to places like Milwaukee and Detroit and Cleveland and Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, right? So big Democrat heavy cities and swing states that could actually, you know, be pretty decisive in the election. And they're going to use those people to try and intimidate people away from polling places. Now that part of the strategy has some very distinct problems with it, which we'll get into later, but suffice to say for now, if that strategy fails to suppress the vote, and it is very likely to, the next phase of this is going to be legal challenges. And the Trump campaign has already been talking about this very openly. Donald Trump has been talking about this very openly. The idea is essentially that the night of the election, if there is not a decision, which there won't be, just given the terms of what's going on, they're going to sue to stop the counting of ballots after the first day. And their argument is going to be all of the ballots that were cast in person were already counted on the first day. All the rest of the ballots might be fraudulent, so we shouldn't count them. And so whoever's winning on the first day should win. Now, the reason that they would make that argument from a sort of political science perspective is actually really obvious. The general sort of assumption of this election cycle is that a lot more Republicans are going to show up in person to vote than Democrats. And so on the first day of the election, we're very likely to see Trump winning. And then after that first day, we're very likely to see Biden winning. That is what has been referred to as sort of a boomerang effect or a sort of post-election shift or something like that. Some people have been calling it the blue shift, right? And there is a period of time in the United States between Election Day and early December in which votes are allowed to be counted, right? I forget the term that Gelman uses, but it's essentially an interim period in which ballots are allowed to be counted, challenged, recounted, blah, blah, blah. The Trump campaign already has recruited a lot, significant number of lawyers, right? And they're already planning on filing these lawsuits, and they've essentially said so out loud. And again, the argument is going to be, well, if votes weren't counted on the first day, if they haven't been counted before the first day, then we have to assume that they're fraudulent, so we can't count them after that. And of course, the reason for that would be, well, very likely that would mean that Trump would win. That's very unlikely to work, too, for a lot of reasons, but one of which being, you know, very specifically that that's not how elections work. And they would have to actually prove real fraud, which they can't. And so that moves then into the third phase. And the third phase is actually one which is really important on a lot of levels, both because of how it shifts what the strategy is for Trump, but also how it shifts very likely how resistance to that would play itself out. And so the thinking is, and Gelman has heard this directly from sources within the Republican Party, as have a couple other journalists since Gelman posted this article. The strategy is that state legislatures that are controlled by Republicans in swing states will invalidate the election results. And they'll just say, this election was invalid. It was full of fraud. We can't trust the results. Therefore, we're going to appoint the Republican electors to go and vote for Donald Trump because he was winning on the first day. Essentially bypassing the entire election. So what that would mean is that regardless of who wins the state, in states that will do this, state legislatures will just send Trump delegates to the Electoral College, even if they didn't win the state, which would essentially, you know, be a coup. If we were to think about this in terms that we would apply to other parts of the world, the idea that a political party would invalidate the electoral process and then manipulate the legal mechanisms in order to retain power, even while losing an election, would be termed a coup. That would be a seizure of power. And so this is what Gelman is arguing here. And the scary part about this is all of the conditions are in place to make that happen. Now, I think that there's a lot of reasons why that won't succeed. But suffice to say, at this point, that's sort of what Gelman is talking about. And so what we wanted to do was sort of have this relatively long discussion tonight about what all of that means, not just in general, but for us as anarchists, because we're entering into a really precarious sort of situation right now.
Yeah, so let's just really kind of break this down into what we think will happen. You know, as you talked about, I encourage people to read this article. You don't even have to read it. There's lots of articles that have been written about this article.
Yeah, yeah.
But as you said, I mean, basically, it's just clear right now. I mean, Trump has said it. I mean, he's made it clear. He said at the Republican convention that the only way they're going to lose, and he said this kind of prepping his base for, you know, their talking points. The only way the Republicans are going to lose this election, he said, is if there's widespread voter fraud. And of course, what's bizarre is that, you know, Trump himself, you know, has voted through absentee ballot voting, you know, through the mail. I mean, yep. The Republicans are counting on people voting through the mail in several areas. I mean, especially among like seniors in Florida. I mean, that's where a lot of the votes come from.
Yeah.
Is through people voting through the mail. And a lot of seniors, I mean, they're not going to go out to the polls. They're not going to risk getting coronavirus. You know, they're already old. They vote through the mail. This is how they've always voted. And the Republicans have even taken out ads, you know, encouraging people to vote through the mail in some areas. So, I mean, this whole thing about, you know, there's widespread voting fraud. I mean, Trump is saying crazy stuff like, you know, people's dogs are getting, like, voting cards and stuff like that. I mean, it's just, it's all ridiculous. There's no, there's nothing there that's credible, but yet they're building up this thing as kind of like a, you know, talking point for their base. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, what this article points out is that they're going to contest the election and that they're going to try to install electors, so people that are basically loyal to Trump in some of these swing states that will then, you know, pull the lever for Trump, and that somehow there might be something in the Supreme Court that it gets, that it goes up to that level. And of course, Trump and the Republicans are trying to put in power, you know, a far right dominionist, anti-choice, anti-LGBTQ, Supreme Court justice right now. So I think the question that everybody has is that how do we see this thing playing out, and what are the scenarios that it could play out?
Yeah, so I think it makes sense to kind of go through this in rings, sort of how Gelman is describing the strategy. And the first ring that he lays out is this sort of attempt to intimidate voters, right? Now, the basic reality is that 50,000 people spread out across the country is not that many. If you even were to concentrate some of those people in major Democratic cities and swing states, the ability to functionally suppress the vote is minimal. And I don't think that that strategy is going to be successful now. With that said, the idea that the Republican Party would send what essentially are far right activists into, you know, Democratic cities, which are, you know, largely non-white and largely made up of people who you know, don't particularly like the far right, is a recipe for political violence. And that would potentially be a way that the Republicans could claim that the election is invalid, is that there was violence at polling places. But nonetheless, if they decide to do this, it could get pretty ugly in some places. And we've already seen this in elections past, right, where the right wing shows up at polling places and there's confrontations and things. But it is very likely that if they send people to a place like Detroit or Cleveland or Milwaukee or Chicago or something like that, that there's likely to be confrontations during the electoral process. Now, that's not going to suppress the vote enough, I think, to actually swing things in Trump's direction. Even if it did, the idea that they sent people out to intimidate people at polling places would pretty much invalidate any win he would have anyways to begin with. But I don't think that that's going to be decisive. And so that leads us to the second sort of phase in this, which is the courts. Now, the idea that the courts would stop vote counting after the first day is pretty absurd. However, that does not mean that there won't be some judges around the country that will try that. We already know that Mitch McConnell has spent the better part of the last 30 years trying to stack federal courts with hardline conservatives who are very loyal to the Republican Party. And it's possible that that could cause enough chaos to, again, not necessarily swing the election in Trump's favor, but to invalidate the electoral process in general. Right. And then we get to the third part of this, which is the part which I think is actually the most interesting. So I think so far, the assumption has been that the election would happen. There would be a ton of problems. Trump would try and rhetorically claim that it was invalid and then refuse to leave the White House. Right. That's been the sort of scenario that most people have been talking about. What Gelman is proposing here is something actually very different than that. In this general scenario that everyone's been talking about, the center of gravity for what happens is Washington, D.C., right? That's where Trump is. That's where the seat of power is. If we can really take any sort of cues from other attempts at around the world of sort of destroying attempts to seize power, those confrontations tend to center around the Capitol, right? And so it's very likely that in the first scenario, that's what would happen. And we've talked about that scenario at length already. But in the second scenario, the one that Gelman is talking about, the center of gravity is actually in the states. That states like Ohio or Pennsylvania or Wisconsin, that the state legislatures would essentially bypass the electoral process. What that would do is that would create multiple centers of gravity for what's going on. If that were to allow Trump to, quote, claim victory in the Electoral College, obviously no one would recognize that. But the resistance that would kick off would look potentially very different. Sure, there would be activity in Washington, D.C., obviously. But there's very likely to be activity in these state capitals as well. Now, we have a model through which to look at what that would potentially look like, and that's Puerto Rico. We talked about Puerto Rico when the uprising in Puerto Rico was going on. And one of the things that we said during that period of time is we have to remember that when they overthrew the governor in Puerto Rico, that was essentially like someone overthrowing the governor of Illinois, right? Puerto Rico is a part of the United States, and people overthrew the governments in Puerto Rico, right? The territorial government. And the reason that they could do that is, well, on a state level, there's just not as many forces that you can mobilize as you could on a federal level. And so the number of people showing up, 100 or 200,000 people showing up in, you know, in a place like Madison, Wisconsin, could be very decisive, could lead to the fall of state governments and things like that. Right. So we have that sort of scenario in play. The thing that gets really frightening about this, however, is that because this would be essentially a coup, there would be political conflict, right? And political conflict, which would be unpredictable. Now, I don't think that there is a reality in which Trump comes out of this ahead. I don't think that that changes with the states being involved in the process. But be that as it may, that does not mean that there won't be significant political violence and there won't be people hurt. There won't be people imprisoned and things like that. Right. And so if the center of gravity shifts to states, I think what the difference here becomes is that, as we talked about maybe a month ago, you know, there was this discussion of, you know, if Trump steals the election or refuses to leave office, essentially shutting the economy down. Now, if he does that by just refusing to accept the results of the election when he obviously loses without using this kind of a strategy, and the center of gravity shifts to D.C., I don't know if that necessarily happens. I don't know if people come and shut cities down and things like that. I think that the center of gravity happens in Washington, D.C., and that's where conflict will be concentrated. But if they try and use a strategy like this, I think we're a lot more likely to see something that is kind of similar to what we saw at the end of May, just maybe not as widespread, right? That we would see conflict on a citywide level in major cities in these states. We have to also keep in mind that Democrats control most of the cities in the United States, and cities are the sort of center of economic circulation and production in the U.S. Even though agricultural areas produce the food, all of that stuff is circulated through cities. All the highways run through cities, everything, right? And so if people in these cities decided to shut these cities down, that would have drastic economic outcomes for the United States. And that could be enough to in itself be decisive, right? And so we have this kind of situation playing itself out in which we have two political parties that are sort of locked in kind of an endgame scenario, right? We have the Republican Party on the one hand who is sort of being pushed in this direction. Whether or not governors of certain states decide to go along with this is a different question entirely. And I think some will and some won't. There's already indications that in Florida, this is definitely going to at least be a possibility. We could definitely see something like this play itself out in Georgia or Texas as well, or even Arizona, states which control enough electoral votes to actually swing an election. Whether governors go along with this is a separate question. And I think that that's going to be very up to kind of the political conditions of the day. But if the Republican Party decides to even begin this strategy, so if they decide to start intimidating people at ballot boxes, at voting places, right? If they decide to try and stop counting votes after the first night, if they decide to invalidate elections on a state level to sort of fix the Electoral College, if that happens, the Republican Party is finished as a political party, that they've entered into a scenario where they have to win, that if they do not win in this situation, if they do not essentially eliminate the structure of representational voting in the United States, they're finished as a political party, right? But at the same time, the Democrats are sort of stuck in this process as well. Because one of the things Gelman talks about, and I think that this is a really critical point, especially for those of us who are sort of in our late 30s, early 40s, that remember this very clearly. In the year 2000, when there was a conflict about the election, there were two things that were really different from this moment. And the first is that increasingly it looks like the election's not going to be particularly close. That if you really look at polling, even 538 is giving Joe Biden like a 75% chance of winning decisively on election. Well, you know, to winning the election by decisive margins, right? And is giving Trump a 10% chance of winning at all, let alone by a decisive margin. That was not the case in 2000. In 2000, the election was incredibly close. George W. Bush did lose the popular vote, but not by a ton. And it really came down to some votes in Florida.
And it seems like Trump's push to do this is coming from that realization. That's yes. What a lot of people are saying. It's basically, he's like, we're not going to win the popular vote. We're not going to win the Electoral College. Like you were saying, this is a Hail Mary move.
Yes, this is a Hail Mary move. The other difference, though, and I think this is the really critical difference. In the year 2000, Al Gore and George W. Bush pushed this all the way up to the Supreme Court, and Gore lost. But there were still legal avenues that he could have pursued to continue the process of fighting to win the election, and would have had legal justification to do that. But after the Supreme Court decision, decided to concede. And in his concession speech, he said, essentially, the reason I'm conceding here is to preserve the tradition of the, quote, peaceful transfer of power, which has characterized American elections since the founding of the country. Right? Essentially, he was not going to kick off a scenario in which there'd be open political warfare in the streets. And he knew that there was at least a possibility of that if he continued to push. This time around, though, Trump has already decided that a peaceful transition of power, quote unquote, is not going to be a thing that he's interested in. He said as much this week. And the Democrats don't really have this option either. Because essentially what we're looking at here is not what we saw in 2000, which was really about who was going to win an election, right? What we're looking at here is actually a scenario in which a political party is saying, we're just going to not do the election thing anymore. And a lot of the supporters of that party are perfectly okay with that. That if they do this and they're able to be successful and the Democrats back down and there's no resistance in the streets, Trump will be able to consolidate power to a degree in which all of this idle chatter of a second or third or fourth term all of a sudden becomes a reality.
Let me just stop you there real quick.
Yeah, yeah.
Why is the street component so important? Why does that matter?
Okay, so the official Democratic Party is not going to endorse open resistance in the streets, right? We just have to come to terms with that. They probably won't get in the way of it, but they're not going to openly endorse it. The reality is that they're going to try and fight this thing through the courts, and they could lose that fight. But at the point where that fight is lost and the election is decisively stolen, there's a choice that needs to be made. And that choice is, do they move outside of the political process and start to engage in resistance, not as a party, but as participants in that party? Or do they just give up and decide that it's over, right? Now, if they decide that it's over, it could be over for a long time. That could also be an endgame. That could be a scenario in which everything changes in America and not for the better, right? That could be a consolidation of authoritarian power, right? As I said before, in another country, this would be a coup. What is very unlikely to happen, though, given how the political climate in the United States is right now, it is very unlikely that a lot of people are going to take that situation sitting down. If the Democrats lose in the courts, right, if they lose through all of the legitimate mechanisms, the only thing that is left for people to do at that point is to hit the streets, right? And that can look like a lot of different things. In the scenario that Gelman's talking about, again, a lot of that resistance could be concentrated around state capitals in states where this happened, right? If Trump just refuses to acknowledge the results and decides he's going to stay in office, a lot of that resistance could happen around D.C. It's very likely that there's probably going to be people trying to shut cities down. There have been unions talking about going on general strike. That in itself could be decisive, right? Shutting the economy down, hitting the streets in sufficient numbers. You know, there's other dynamics in play here that we've also talked about, such as the fact that, well, the military is probably not going to intervene to keep Trump in office. Lots of elements of the federal government are not loyal to him, and those people will stop working, especially members of AFSCME who could just go on strike. And so the calculus of a conflict situation does not work out in the Trump administration's favor or in the Republican Party's favor. And that is why street resistance is decisive here. Because again, we go back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show. If we take those numbers as far as how many people participated in demonstrations, just in the millennial and Zoomer generations, that's, I think the number we calculated before the show was like 27 million people or something had gone to a demonstration at some point since the end of May. So if we put that in context, the biggest day of global protest in human history was May 15th, 2003, before the war in Iraq started. 15 million people globally showed up that day. There were more people that have showed up to demonstrations in the United States since May. If those same 27 million people hit the streets, even if no one else does, that's a decisive change in the political climate. That in itself could fundamentally change the outcome of this situation, whether or not the Democrats want to be involved. But the reality is here is that even though the Republicans are getting dragged into this, right, because, you know, they've been supporting Trump this entire time. And essentially, the Republicans realize something, which I think kind of is getting talked about in the press, but not nearly enough. As I mentioned before, they have lost the aggregate popular vote for the White House, the House of Representatives, and the Senate in every single election since 2008, right? Even the elections where they gained seats, they lost in the aggregate popular vote by pretty significant margins. And this also happens in many states that are controlled by Republicans. The Republican Party is a minority political party in the United States, yet somehow they are in control of all of the levers of government. And I think what is starting to dawn on a lot of them is that the time on that is ticking, and it is not going to last very long. And this sort of willingness to accept a seizure of power that you're seeing from even mainstream Republican politicians at this point is deriving from a recognition of that reality, right? And so this is a strategy for them to compensate for that. It is also an endgame strategy. It is a strategy where they either win everything or lose everything. For the Democratic Party, though, if they don't fight, they will lose legitimacy in the eyes of much of the American public as an entity which has any hope of actually changing anything ever again. They will essentially collapse under the weight of their own failure if they're not willing to stand up in this situation. Because again, if they don't, there's not going to be another opportunity for potentially quite a while. And I think that that is increasingly being recognized, right?
How do you see this thing playing out in terms of, like, how do you see the dominoes falling? You know, let's say, you know, it's election night, things are happening, the votes are coming in.
yeah, what do you see happening? Just Trump saying, like, that's it. Like, you know, I'm winning. I've got more votes right now, like, as the night's closing out. Or do you see them, like, switching to going after certain states, taking it to the Supreme Court? I mean, what would it look like?
Yeah, so the implementation of a plan like this is going to play out on election night mostly, right? What we're going to see very likely on election night is Trump is probably going to be winning. More Republicans are going to show up in person to vote. Well, because, you know, they've been convinced that coronavirus isn't real. And so they're going to show up in risky situations and vote. Also, more Republicans live in rural areas where there's not nearly the same concentration of people at a polling place, right, as there would be in a city. People that live in cities and people that are traditional Democratic voters have, by a wide margin, requested mail-in ballots during this election cycle. And so on election night, it's very likely that's going to look like Trump is winning. Now, of course, if we look at the total number of votes counted, which, of course, everyone displays, it'll be a very small number. I'm thinking under 25 or 30%, maybe up to 50% of all the votes in the country would have been counted by the end of the first day. But there is this sort of concept in political science, which arises from the 2000 election, which is sort of this bias of impression sort of idea. And one of the reasons that political scientists argue that Bush was able to really push through and, you know, claim victory in that election was, well, on the first night, he was winning in Florida. And then after the first night, he was losing. But for most Americans, he had won that election, or at least as far as they were paying attention, he had won that election. And so the idea that the result of the election in Florida would shift created the space for conspiracy theories to arise, right? We were talking about this a little bit before we started recording today, but the sort of famous culminating moment in Florida was this thing that's referred to as the Brooks Brothers riot, which was when a bunch of Republican interns and staffers and just sort of young Republicans showed up in Florida and tried to physically shut down recounting places. And all of that was organized by Roger Stone. Right. Roger Stone had convinced all of these people that Democrats were driving trucks full of ballots into the back doors and blah, blah. He fostered conspiracy theories because the space of which was existed because on the night of the election, it looked like Bush was going to win. And then as time went on and more absentee ballots got counted, it looked increasingly like he wasn't going to. And so Stone said, that's fraud. What we're looking at is a very similar strategy just played out on a national scale. That on the first night, I mean, again, popular vote in the United States doesn't mean much, right? We've all seen that. You know, two out of the last five elections have been won by the person who did not win the popular vote, right? Bush once and Donald Trump. Popular votes don't matter. What does matter are these sort of very specific swing states, right? And right now there's, I think, 8 or 9 states in play. Trump has to win essentially every single one of them in order to have a chance of winning the election, and has to hold on to every single state that he won last time, right? The chances of that happening in reality are incredibly slim. If we really look at the electoral map at the moment, they're incredibly small. But on election night, that's not what it's going to look like. On election night, it's going to look like he's winning states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan, and states like Georgia and Texas and Arizona, right? North Carolina. It's going to look like he's winning in all of those places. And it's going to look, by all perceptions, specifically of people that aren't paying particularly close attention, that he's going to win the election. Now, as that changes, as votes get counted, what that does is it creates the room for conspiracy theory. Now, Trump and the Trump campaign and even the Republican Party in general has been priming the ground for that conspiracy theory to grow for months already. They've been talking about people stuffing ballot boxes. I mean, Trump started building up this narrative in 2016. When he said, oh, you know, well, like, I won the Electoral College, but I also won the popular vote because, like, millions of people voted illegally in California, right? Absolutely no evidence of that. But he's gone with it anyways, and he still keeps running with it. If you look at the numbers and polling, the vast majority of Republicans are convinced that if Trump loses, that it's because he lost because of fraud, even before the election occurs. And so they primed the ground to be able to make this argument. And the argument that they're going to make is they're going to say, on night one, we were winning. And by the end of the first week, we were losing. So how did that happen? It has to be fraud. And so the way that that'll play out is they will try to stop recounts in the states through the court system first, right? In some states, they might win their initial cases and then lose on appeal or lose in the state Supreme Court or whatever. It's not likely that they're going to win many of those cases, but that's not really the point. The point of all of this is to continually invalidate the results. So even if they lose the court cases, then they can say, oh, well, it's the courts that were stacked by the Democrats that ruled against us. So of course they're trying to help Joe Biden steal the election, right? And then that sets the ground for what Gelman's talking about actually really happening, which is state legislatures just deciding that the elections in their states were invalid and just appointing Trump delegates to the Electoral College, essentially bypassing the entire election. That's very likely how that would play out. Now, if that were to happen, that wouldn't happen until mid-December when the Electoral College meets, which I think is December 13th, if I'm not wrong, but somewhere in that sort of area of mid-December. That would be the moment in which, if resistance is going to manifest, it's going to happen then. And it will happen sort of around the Electoral College vote when things become sort of solidified. And the reason is that most Democrats are convinced, again, this is by polling, that the vote count is going to change over time. Right? That they have a sort of realistic understanding that Trump is likely to be winning on the first day and that that's likely to change as votes get counted. Right? And so it is very likely that a lot of people that are sort of in the opposition to Trump, which I think the term I'm using Democrats, but I think that that's inaccurate. It's people that aren't Trump supporters, essentially. A lot of them are going to be willing to wait a couple of weeks here and there to wait for the votes to get counted. But if courts actually functionally shut down vote counts, or if state legislatures decide to just ignore the results and just sort of push through a slate of electors, that is when we would see resistance breaking out in the streets. And there's already many of these kind of groups like Indivisible and Move On, as well as groups like the AFL-CIO and stuff, that are already talking about contingency plans for things like this.
Another big overarching question. Before we were talking, you were saying that you feel confident that that Trump can lose from this. It's decisive that people be engaged and act. Explain that. Why are you confident that this is not so doom and gloom if we're ready to, you know, stand up for ourselves?
Well, it doesn't mean it's not doom and gloom, because a Biden presidency isn't super great either. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But we have to look at the balance of force here, right? And we have to look at this on the level of sort of logistics, essentially, and economics, and really start to talk about where people live and what sorts of actions could be taken, right? So I want to think about this on three separate levels. I want to think about this on the level of what happens in a place like Washington, D.C. I want to think about this on the level of what happens in a place like, Madison, Wisconsin, right? Just choose a city, or Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, or something like that, which are sort of small capital cities and really big states. They're sort of swing states. And then what happens sort of outside of that? Like, what happens sort of generally throughout the United States, and what the sort of possibilities are here, and kind of what people are talking about. So to start on the level of Washington, D.C., and we've talked about this in past episodes at length, but In a scenario in which hundreds of thousands of people go to Washington, D.C., we have to think about one very basic reality, which has shifted in the United States over the last 4 or 5 months, which is that tens of thousands of people in the U.S. have now experienced direct police repression, have experienced getting tear gassed, have experienced either getting hit with rubber bullets or watching people get hit with rubber bullets. They're not the same passive participants that you saw in the anti-war movement, right? They're not the same 450,000 people that are going to show up in Washington, D.C. And instead of refusing to leave and stopping the war, they're going to just dutifully get on buses and go home, right? We're looking at a very different political scenario now for a number of reasons. One of those reasons, again, is that a lot of Americans have now participated in direct resistance. Before this, I mean, we've seen kind of huge upticks in this. Like, we saw an uptick in this during Occupy. We saw an uptick in this in 2014 and 15. But increasingly, what's happened is that the reality that a lot of us lived in 10 years ago, in which people that had experienced things like that were very small in number compared to, like, even people that were generally involved in grassroots politics. Now we're looking at that being a relatively normal experience, to the point where publications like Teen Vogue are writing stories about how to deal with getting hit with rubber bullets, right? CNN put out articles about what to do if you get tear gassed. I mean, it's become so normal, like normalized at this point, that mainstream media outlets are talking about this. What that means is that when people do go to a place like DC in a situation like this, it is very unlikely that they're just going to immediately back down. Partially because of that, partially because the stakes in this situation are super high. Again, if Trump is able to pull this off, we're not talking about him just serving another term and then leaving. We are talking about a person who is going to be able to, without any challenge, consolidate power within the federal state to the degree in which we could declare that authoritarianism. Now, that transition is kind of strange to talk about in an American context, and I think hard to imagine, but we've already watched elements of that happen. We've already watched the Trump administration take over the Department of Justice. We've already watched the administration take over the Department of Homeland Security and use those two departments in concert to engage in propagandizing and to engage in direct political repression on levels that we couldn't have even imagined even 4 or 5 years ago. Right. Even when he got into office, I think it was difficult to imagine that things would have sort of gone this far outside of what we would have considered political normality. Right. And so the stakes are really high in this situation, not just for anarchists. Right. I mean, we have to think about this on the level of, if he is able to consolidate power, we are going to get crushed. Right. They are going to come after us with everything they have. Partially because nothing's going to stand in their way, and partially because they need the propaganda victory. It is likely not going to look very good for us. And so just on the level of self-defense, it's important for us to get out there, even if Joe Biden ascending to power is not a necessarily great outcome, right? Because he's going to do the same thing to a degree. And again, I'll talk about some of that calculus in a second. But if we think about the DC situation, the military has already been very clear that they're not going to intervene. Right? We're not going to see a situation in which people are in DC facing off with tanks. We are going to see a situation in which people are in DC facing off against the Department of Homeland Security, in which people are facing off against the DC police if the DC police decide to intervene, which they might or might not. I mean, we have to keep in mind, Washington, DC is one of the most progressive areas in the entire United States. And so it's questionable whether the city government will even authorize the police to intervene in a situation like that. And so in DC, we're likely to see a situation in which the people in the street have a vast, vast advantage on the level of just sheer numbers, as well as potentially on the level of force, right? But once we leave DC, we see a different calculus, right? In states and state capitals, we're also likely to see a situation in which, I mean, we already saw kind of precursors of this in Madison, Wisconsin already, where people sort of took over the state house for a period of time. We've seen examples of this in Columbus, Ohio, where, you know, protesters were able to overwhelm police and smash windows on the state house, right? You know, these are not unprecedented situations. You know, again, we also saw this happen in Puerto Rico, where hundreds of thousands of people hit the street and through tenacity and attrition were able to essentially overthrow the government of Puerto Rico. there's precedent for this, right? And there are models for this. And I think that, again, as I said before, we are very likely to see situations like that at least beginning to play themselves out in state capitals. But I think what's probably going to be most decisive is actually what happens outside of these situations. So again, let's think about the United States as a sort of metropolitan logistics, right? So as a flow of resources and capital and, you know, electricity and, you know, internet connectivity and things like this, right? The vast majority of those concentrations happen in cities. And those cities are largely run by Democrats. They're largely made up by people who are politically progressive, that increasingly oppose the administration with, in pretty strong terms. And in that situation, and again, we saw precursors of this during the anti-war movement, where when the war started, at least five cities shut down completely, right? People just cut off all the roads and shut down traffic from the freeways and just gridlocked the whole city. And they were doing that often with very small numbers. In a situation like this, we are not likely to see small numbers. We are likely to see something a lot more like what we saw at the end of May, where large numbers of people hit the streets. The difference is in this situation is likely to be much more persistent. So in a lot of places at the end of May, there were a couple of days of really intense conflict. There have been demonstrations that have happened since. In some places, they're still very much going on at a relatively significant sort of frequency. But they haven't hit the level of intensity that they hit at the end of May in most places, right? Of course, not counting Portland and even Seattle and New York and a few other cities, right? Louisville, obviously. But in this situation, it's not even going to take necessarily massive rioting. It's just going to take refusal. You know, like there's always been this idea of, you know, in the IWW sort of lexicon, there's always this concept of the general strike being the day that all the workers just sit down. It is entirely possible that we will see a scenario like that. People just say no. They're just not going to do it anymore. They don't have to risk anything if they do that. They just have to not show up, right? Not go to work, not go to the store, right? Maybe drive your car into the freeway and stop it to block a freeway or something like that, right? But it doesn't even take many people to do something like that. But it's very likely that through kind of progressive circles, the idea that we can just all strike and shut everything down is likely to probably spread really easily. In that situation, the entire economy would be crippled.
Not only that, but I mean, that's the easiest way to stop things from becoming some sort of like far right wet dream of like, yeah, you know, Antifa versus the Patriots or something like that. Yeah. I mean, if we want to actually create a situation in which violence is just either minimized or non-existent, you know, besides, you know, whatever the police decide to do if they decide to attack people, then yeah, like you said, I mean, as the IWW slogan goes, I mean, the most power we have is when we put our hand in our pockets and just stop. And if that takes place along with, you know, coastal cities perhaps engaging in actions that have happened in the past, like for instance port shutdowns, I mean, that could be very powerful. I mean, that's definitely happened in the past. I mean, I guess we'll see what people end up doing. Do you have more to say on this? Or
yeah, it also – so the other element here that people have been talking about frequently is the role of right-wing paramilitaries in this whole situation, right? I think the assumption has been, well, the right-wing paramilitaries are going to show up and they're going to initiate political violence. And that probably still is going to happen. I don't think that there's any way to avoid that reality. However – in the scenario that seems to be sort of growing in likelihood, in which we are likely to see widespread massive resistance to an attempt to consolidate federal power and invalidate the election, right-wing paramilitaries are irrelevant. It doesn't mean that they won't try. It doesn't mean that people won't get hurt. But they're not going to be able to stop protests in every city shutting cities down. They're just not. There's not enough of them. I think we have started to really kind of come to terms with this, right? That the number of right-wing paramilitaries in the United States, though they are more numerous than they should be, and though they are scary and loud and prone to violence, they're not actually that numerous. You know, there might be 20,000 of them in the entire country that are willing to actually arm up and essentially engage in what would be equivalent to terrorism. But that's not going to be enough to restart the economy. And that's not going to be enough to get people to go back to work. And that's not going to be enough to get people off the streets all over the country, right? They're really, at the end of the day, the power lives in the cities in the United States, even though in rural areas, you know, there is a lot of sort of agricultural production and even production on level of like resource extraction, things like that. Again, all of that flows through urban areas, right? And all it takes
is for people to just... Well, especially if the immigrant community comes on board and they get involved in resistance and they decide to strike too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all it really takes to push this back is for people to just say no, right? And just refuse to participate until everything falls apart.
The devil's advocate here. So what would you say to somebody that would be like, okay, I hear what you're saying, general strike, blah, blah, blah. But look, Trump has amassed massive amounts of power in the DHS. This is a question of forces. They have a ton of violence. I mean, you know, they're more than capable of pushing people off the streets, getting them to go home, to go back to work, or, you know, maybe they don't even care. So what if we have a general strike? I mean, they're going to do their own thing in the halls of power. Maybe they don't even care what people
are doing. Yeah, so in that first argument, people that are making that argument are delusional to think that the Department of Homeland Security is that powerful. Like, they are powerful, don't get me wrong, right? But the entire department has, like, I think the number that came forward was 60,000 personnel. Assume 70% of those are loyal to Trump, okay? And that's a huge assumption. I mean, you have to keep in mind what they're essentially risking there. if they're loyal to Trump and they lose that fight, all of them lose their jobs. Many of them will get prosecuted. It will destroy their lives, right? They'll be considered traitors for the rest of their lives for doing that. It's a huge price to pay. But even say 70% of the DHS is loyal to Trump. Okay, so that's like 40,000. About a third of those are paper pushers, right? They're not people with guns. They just kind of push paper, right? So now we're down to, you know, 25,000. 25,000 personnel would have to deploy across the entire United States, which, you know, for any Americans that have been to Europe, I think it becomes really clear. The United States is huge. Just geographically, it's a massive space with 400 plus million people in it, right? Many of those millions live in cities. And so the idea that 25,000 Department of Homeland Security personnel that would have to run on shifts would be able to put down, say, even half the number of people that showed up at protests between May and now show up. That's still 13 million people in the streets. That's delusional. It's not real. Now, of course, police forces are going to be involved in that as well. But we already saw at the end of May what happens when a determined group of people hits the street and the cops decide to attack them. They get run off the streets really quickly, right? Now, that situation didn't get pushed, but the reality of what happened at the end of May is that the National Guard had to get deployed to, I forgot the number of cities. It was like 65 cities or something like that across the United States in the same week. And the reason they had to do that is that the police could not control the streets anymore. That's the only reason the National Guard would have to come occupy the streets. Like where I live, they were in the city I live in for 3 weeks trying to make sure that protests wouldn't pop back up because the cops lost control so thoroughly on the first day. And they lost control the second they launched the first tear gas canister. That's all it took, right? We have to remember, even in large cities, there's maybe a couple thousand to a few thousand police. I mean, New York City is an exception, obviously, right? Like huge cities like Chicago are an exception. But for your normal medium to large American city, there might be 1,000 to 2,000 police in the whole city running on, say, 12-hour shifts, and a third of them are paper pushers, right? That's not enough to control a crowd of 50,000 people, 25, 50,000 people, especially if they're willing to really go. That's not enough to control a crowd of 3,000 people, right? And so you start to think about that happening all over the country. Where are they going to get tear gas after the first couple of days? How are they going to get supplies for their vehicles? You know, like they start running into supply problems really quickly in situations like this, because I think a lot of us think of federal law enforcement and local law enforcement as these kind of impenetrable institutions. But if we learned anything at the end of May, it's that they're actually incredibly fragile. And all it takes sometimes is a little bit of pushing, and they'll just fall right over because we vastly outnumber them, vastly outnumber them, if we really break it down to just sheer numbers. So then the second argument, who cares if everyone shuts the cities down? They're going to do what they want in the halls of power. That argument entirely ignores the fundamental connection in a capitalist economy between the state and the economy. Right. Libertarians have this like dream world in which capitalism functions without the state. But the state guarantees, and this is basic Marx, right? Like Capital, Volume 1. When you produce a product, you're producing that product not for the present moment. You're producing that product to be able to sell that product in a future moment. And the role of the state, and this is, you know, openly talked about by institutions like the International Monetary Fund, is to create what the IMF calls stable investment conditions. What stable investment conditions mean is, well, there's not massive strikes. There's not people shutting highways down. There's not huge political crises that threaten to topple an entire government, right? That in situations like that, people can't, quote, invest. And if no one's going to work or driving trucks or allowing cars on freeways to move, it doesn't really matter whether you're making stuff or not. If that happens, the entire economy will implode, and it won't actually take very long. We saw how fast that could happen in 2008, for those of us that remember back to 2008, which was 12 years ago. But we saw the entire U.S. economy implode just through sheer economic contradictions in the course of a few months, right? If we were really to see the sort of scale of strike that is conceivable in this situation, even if it's just confined to cities, we're talking about an economy grinding to a halt almost overnight, right? Now, of course, the stock market, as we've seen with coronavirus, continues, right? Because the stock market has no connection to material economic reality at this point. But that does not mean that the economy continues to function, right? That does not mean that the situation doesn't become increasingly resistant because of that. And that does not mean that just because the stock market's going up, that people in DC can maintain control of the situation anymore, right? So the idea that what happens in the halls of power is divorced from the economic situation on the ground is a misunderstanding of how politics functions in the United States.
What do you see as the role of autonomous movements in all of this?
There are no good outcomes, really. That we are faced with a scenario in which if Trump is able to consolidate power, it is very likely that the state is going to come after us, right? In ways that are much more catastrophic than we're seeing even currently, even though the situation's already pretty bad, which necessitates us participating in this, even just as a means of self-defense, right? But then there's the flip side of that. And I want to go back to Biden's speech he gave in Pittsburgh. And what he said in Pittsburgh is, I support the protests, but I'm going to crack down on the arsonists and the rioters and the anarchists. And he specifically named anarchists in that speech. Now, if we think back to the Obama years, for those of us that were active during the Obama years, if we think back to the Obama years, I think liberals tend to think of the Obama years as these sort of halcyon days where everything was great. But for anarchists and autonomists in the United States, the Obama years were horrible. We saw levels of federal repression that in a lot of ways outstripped what happened under the Bush administration. We saw vast, vast, vast increases in the scale of surveillance. We saw tactics of infiltration used against people all over the United States. We saw the FBI entrap people at a rate that was almost unthinkable. We saw the federal government coordinate with the FBI through police think tanks the crackdown on Occupy in a strategy which involved multiple rings of repression and systematically tearing apart Occupy's sort of supply structures and flows of people. All of that happened under Obama. And what that is that is counterinsurgency, right? The Democratic Party, you know, we've talked about it in certain terms so far. The Democratic Party is a party which co-opts autonomous political initiatives and pulls moderate elements of those into its own fold as a way to sort of revalorize the electoral process. But I want to talk about it in slightly different terms. The Democratic Party is a party built on the outcomes of counterinsurgency. That what they have done since the 1960s, and I'm not even talking about the late 60s, I'm talking about the early 60s, in their approaches to the civil rights movement, what they have done is they've taken an approach in which they attempt to delegitimize militant or radical elements of every political initiative that arises in the United States, and crush them with the force of the state, right? COINTELPRO, yeah, was really bad under Nixon, but it was also horrible under Lyndon Johnson too, right? And they're able to sort of recuperate what's happening back into the Democratic Party. And if we really look at what the Democratic Party is at this point, it is largely the elements of these political initiatives that were recuperated back into the state while they watched the people that they had fought alongside get crushed. I mean, we can clearly see this with organizations like the AFL-CIO, right? Who was literally made up of two trade unions, which were, you know, encouraged to exist by the state, largely to crush more radical workers' initiatives, right? They were organizations which were able to gain membership and were able to gain political power by facilitating the, you know, sort of anti-communist fervor in the 1950s. Because what they did is they used that to get rid of the communists inside of their own ranks to consolidate power amongst the moderates, who then gained power inside the Democratic Party. We watched the same thing happen with the civil rights movement. We watched the same thing happen with the anti-Vietnam War movement, and so on and so on and so on. And so what Biden is proposing in his speech in Pittsburgh is that that is exactly what he will do again, right? And so on some level, we're stuck in a really difficult place where we can't not participate in a resistance that would arise to Trump stealing the election. Not because we care about electoralism, but because we care about our friends. We care about the people that we fought alongside for years now, many of us, right? We care about those people's families, right? We care about each other. We care about the people that might not even identify in the same way that we do, but that we've, you know, shared the experience of struggle with. All of us are at risk if Trump is able to pull off the strategy that Barton Gellman is talking about. Because at the point where that happens, there's nothing to stop him from coming after us. All of us are equally at risk, maybe not equally, but at risk in a different way, but potentially in no less of a degree, if Joe Biden wins at the end of this. Now, there is not the possibility, I think, in this moment to really think about this conflict leading to some sort of fundamentally different world. I don't think that that's in the offing right now. For as much as in my heart of hearts, I would love to hope for that to be true, I don't think that it is. I think that there is a possibility of pushing forward in the direction that we would want, creating dynamics that are potentially going to allow us to jump off in the future, undermining the legitimacy of a Biden administration by pointing out that even though people are willing to get rid of Donald Trump, that does not give Joe Biden a mandate to enact his program. It's going to involve us being allies with people that we're not traditionally allies with. And it's going to involve us being willing to fight after this initial phase is all over. Because if we allow ourselves to get isolated, and if we allow a Biden administration to consolidate power, we are again at risk. And so the only way for us to be able to come out of this okay, or even ahead of where we are now, is to be willing to get out there, but not put everything into it. Is to not risk everything for Joe Biden, but is to build alliances where we need to work with people we don't traditionally work with, to work across political lines, even in an idea of temporary alliance, right? Which is something that normally I find absolutely abhorrent and disgusting, but in this moment, it strategically makes sense. It means being alongside people that we don't traditionally fight alongside of. And it means building connection and friendships in those situations, because those friendships, those connections, those alliances, the trust that gets built is going to ultimately be the thing that will prevent a Biden administration from coming after people that are involved in autonomous social movements, people that traditionally are on the stick end of the carrot and stick calculation that's involved in counterinsurgency, right? Because again, right now we are stuck between Trump consolidating power in something which increasingly approximates open authoritarianism. And Joe Biden being able to consolidate power in a regime which goes back to Obama-era counterinsurgency. we can't let either of those outcomes happen without challenge. And we have to be willing to, again, work alongside people that we're not used to working alongside and be willing to fight after this is over. Because that's going to be the only way that we can protect ourselves in this situation, right? I know a lot of people are having these conversations locally about, you know, how to stay safe during all of this. And that's a really hard discussion to have. And it's even more difficult to have a real answer. But what it doesn't mean is sitting back and watching everything play out. Because if we sit back and we watch everything play out, we might end up having a very poor outcome from that. In fact, I will say we will end up having a very poor outcome from that.
Like, we need mass numbers on the streets. Yeah. Type action.
Yes, we do. Yeah. I mean, we need to be thinking about the scale that we saw during the anti-war movement. We're talking hundreds of thousands of people, even tens of thousands in individual cities, right? I mean, that's the kind of scale that we're really having to think on at this moment, I think. And not like the anti-war movement where people sort of pointlessly marched around in circles and then went home. But those numbers with the mentality that people have now.
I mean, I think this might be another point to stick on for a second, is just that it seems like we're going to enter a period very quickly where it's like suddenly like three states are like the battleground. Yes. Literally. You know, they talk about battleground states. It may be like that. And I guess my question is, what does that even mean? What does that look like?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question because we don't know. Let's say that Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Wisconsin. Okay, let's just like throw three swing states out where this is potentially likely. Decide to do something where they just send Trump delegates to the Electoral College, and many people show up in those state capitals, and governors need to start resigning, and people in state legislatures need to start resigning. What does that mean? The reality is we don't know what that means. We have no idea. It's really a question of not what that means on a metapolitical level, but what that means locally in those cities, right? How are people doing these things? What is the result of that, right? We can't be going into these things blind, but at the same time, we can't really have a roadmap for this. We have no real idea. If we really want to approximate some sort of a roadmap, the best real allusions we can draw are to things like the collapse of the Soviet Union, which when that happened, governments in some of these sort of constituent republics, quote unquote, republics of the Soviet Union, were taken down. And as they were taken down, they were unfortunately replaced. But they were replaced with regimes which were not compliant with the Soviet structure, right? We're not willing to go along with what the Soviet state wanted to do. And it was in that breakdown of the unity of the Soviet Union, the breakdown of the economy of the Soviet Union, that we actually fundamentally watched the Soviet Union fully collapse. Now, in that collapse, I mean, if you even look at a place like West Germany, yeah, people think about the fall of the Berlin Wall and stuff. But I really would encourage people to look into the background biography story of Vladimir Putin for a moment to get an idea of what this looks like. So Putin, I forget which city he was based in, but he was running a KGB office in some medium-sized city in Western Germany. And people in that city had, at that point, like, burned the government building to the ground, and they were sort of like marching around. Like, the cops had all abandoned their police stations and people had occupied the police stations. They're sort of walking around, sort of occupying government buildings sort of unchallenged, right? And they come upon the KGB office, and Vladimir Putin is the only person in that KGB office. And there's like 500 or 600 people outside throwing rocks at the windows and, you know, generally laying siege to the building. And he walks out of the building with a handgun and shoots it in the air and tells everyone that they're not getting in. And they storm the building anyways. And he left. And he radioed back to central office to ask what to do. And there was no one on the other side. Because when states collapse, they don't collapse in one huge historical moment based on a storming of the Winter Palace, right? All of that is historical fiction. It's retroactive, legendary retellings of things which justify certain political positions, right? In the case of the storming of the Winter Palace, it's a story that's meant to valorize Leninism. The reality is that in all of these situations, I mean, we could talk about what happened in Ukraine in 2014. We could talk about what happened in Egypt in 2010, right? In all of these situations, there are these sort of places that everyone focuses on. But in local areas outside of those cities, there's also massive resistance going on. There are also police abandoning their posts. There are also people occupying government buildings. Right. And it's the aggregate effect of that logistical degradation which causes the state to collapse. It's not that people in Kiev were willing to face off with a few government snipers in, you know, the middle of the streets and have people get shot and killed and still continue to push forward. That wasn't what was decisive. What was decisive was that and the fact that in every other medium to large city in Ukraine, the economy had been entirely shut down. Government buildings were being occupied by people, right? And the police had essentially abandoned their posts. It was the aggregate effect of the collapse of the logistics of the police nationally that caused the state to collapse, right? And so what that looks like if it plays out in a few states, like American states, is a really big question. And part of that question really rests on how we understand the role of states in relation to the election and how we understand the role of states in relation to federal power. You know, are we looking at a situation in which people say occupy the state house in Madison, Wisconsin, just don't leave, right? And what does that mean at that point? We don't really know. What we can say is that that is a collapse of the American state functionally.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's interesting, too. I mean, one thing we didn't mention was that, you know, today Trump announced for like the third time that they were going to designate Antifa a terrorist organization along with the KKK, which, I mean, you know, we've gone over this so many times. I mean, there's numerous things that have been written. I mean, there is no physical legal infrastructure to designate groups as domestic terrorist organizations. Terrorism is like a international designation. Yes. And also there was some language I saw online that this is like, you know, he's going to do this after he wins. So it's kind of like reaching out to his base, but this was also included in a package for like aimed at the African American community. So it was like, hey, we're going to go after the KKK for you, which I mean, if anybody's been paying attention to like who's been leading the charge in terms of like far right racist violence, it hasn't been quote the KKK for a long time. And also it's like, oh, by the way, we're going to like throw in like people that oppose that group you know, for my supporters. My point bringing this up is that they're still trying to paint this picture of like, you know, there's all these people and then there's the naughty protesters at the heart of it that are ones that are like secretly coordinating on this. And how are they funded? Who's controlling them? We may never know, you know, but at the point when they're like, literally like facing off against like, you know, your grandpa and your uncle and your uncle who's the shop steward at the local carpenters union, half the people on your street. I mean, what is their argument going to be then that Antifa is like telling them to like take over the state capitol because the government wants to steal their vote?
Well, I mean, we're seeing this happen in Belarus right now, right? Like people are still on the streets in Belarus. And one of the things that's happened, it's kind of become sort of a viral phenomena in Belarus is people. So the riot police in Belarus are federal unit, right? Like the crowd control police are not local. They're federal. And people in the riot police have sort of there's been this sort of viral phenomena of them doing these videos where they go, you know, I was in the police and I was doing that because I was being misled by the government. And I saw my neighbor out on the street as we were tear gassing a group of protesters, and I can't do this anymore. And then they throw their uniform in the trash can and light it on fire. Right. That is when you start to see actual degradation in the state. Right. It's not when an isolated group of activists hits the street that is separate from sort of the space that they're fighting in to engage in some frontal conflict with the state. It's when that conflict generalizes, right? When those distinctions between, quote, people that are involved in politics and the dude who's the steward for the local carpenters union entirely breaks down. And all of a sudden, yeah, you're facing off in the streets with the people who bag your groceries, right? Or the people who sign your insurance policies or things like that, right? That changes things profoundly when that happens. And one of the things that we have seen since May, and one of the things that very much separates this uprising from, say, Occupy, is that this uprising has that characteristic. That a lot of the people participating in what's going on right now are normal, everyday people. They're not raging radical college activists, blah, blah, blah. They're regular people that are responding to the injustices of their everyday lives. And that creates the conditions for there to be something that actually functionally is able to resist a coup attempt, which is what we're really talking about here, right? Is people being able to repress a coup attempt. But again, that doesn't look like just 400,000 people in Washington, D.C., or just 20 or 30,000 people in Madison, Wisconsin. That also looks like 5,000 people in Akron, Ohio, right? Or 5,000 people in Scranton, Pennsylvania, right? Being willing to shut things down, being willing to take action where they are, right? Because it doesn't require necessarily everybody to be in one place. I think we have this illusion that power emanates from Washington, D.C. And we're all taught that. But we have to really think about what the state is. Right. What happens in Washington, D.C. is the bureaucratic element of the state. It's people that make declarations. They sign policies. Right. They give orders to people. But the reality is that the government functions as a diffuse force that spreads through space, that enters into and shapes our lives. Right. Not because it's always present, but because it's able to manage crisis. It's able to manage structures like how people that are impoverished get food, things like that, right? That diffuse logistics isn't necessarily something that can deal with crisis. And we've seen that since January, how much the state has broken down because of the pandemic, how much that breakdown has accelerated because of the uprising, right? We've already watched significant portions of what we understood as the impenetrability of the American state fall apart, right? That we're not going up against, you know, the Imperial Army from Star Wars, right? We're going up against a degraded former superpower, right? A state which can barely function anymore. In which state governments are fighting with the federal government over masks for doctors, right? In which old people are starting to worry about getting denied health insurance in the middle of a pandemic.
One more kind of follow-up on that. I mean, not that we can necessarily know about this, but let's say what we're saying predictably happens with Trump and that, you know, people begin to protest and demonstrate. What happens for, say, like, you know, a state like California or New York, where, like, you know, you mentioned this, they've already kind of had this tit for tat you know, thing with like the coronavirus, you know, what happens to these states which are very much entrenched in opposing Trump? Like, what happens with them?
Yeah, well, and I think that this is, this really gets down to how far people inside the Democratic Party are really willing to go. So there's really two questions here. It's like, how do people in New York City residents react to this? Or how do residents of California react to this? Or how do residents of upstate New York react to this? Or Vermont or wherever? And then how do the governments of those states or areas or cities react to this, right? So on some level, we have to recognize that a lot of economic circulation in the United States centers on the coasts, right? It centers on things like the Port of Oakland, right? Or Los Angeles or New York City, right? These cities which vast amounts of economic traffic are coming in and out of all the time. Right, in which economic power is really very heavily concentrated. Those places getting functionally shut down have huge outsized impacts on what happens everywhere else. Right. And if people are able to do that in those places, which again, it's really a question how much local governments are going to even resist that in this situation. If people are able to do that in those places, that's a significant shift in the way that this could play out. But state governments could also take very specific actions. They could say, refuse to acknowledge the authority of the federal government, right? They could refuse access to federal personnel. Cuomo already talked about doing this, right? Trump threatened to bring the National Guard and the Department of Homeland Security into New York City. And the governor of New York literally said, I will set up roadblocks on the highways into the state to make sure that does not happen. Right. That's not necessarily secession in the sense that they would not be declaring that they're seceding from the country. But it would be a functional cutting off of themselves from the circulation of the rest of the United States. Keep in mind, California alone is what, like the eighth biggest economy in the world just by itself, like even without the rest of the United States, that it has a gross domestic product larger than the vast majority of countries on earth. And if California were to just say, we're just not going to participate anymore as a state, that could be decisive just in itself, right? Even if very little else happens in California, which I think is unlikely in this situation.
Well, just to kind of wrap it up, I mean, we could go on forever about this, but it seems like what you're saying is that as long as people basically don't allow the Democrats to basically pick the cadence in which people respond to this, that they are mobilized and activated and basically pushing their own interests forward, that people will be in a good space. But if we just basically allow them to oppose this through, you know, trying to get the Republicans to be on board, that, you know, we'll be screwed.
Yeah. I mean, essentially, if we allow the Democrats to dictate the pace of what happens here, the best outcome that we will have is a consolidated Biden presidency, right? Which will be, well, a Biden presidency. So pretty much a return back to the way things were 8 years or 4 years ago, right? So not great. Complete with counterinsurgency, complete with the expansion of the surveillance state, right? Which is not what any of the people in the street are fighting for now, currently, right? And most of the people won't be fighting for in a situation like this. That the reality is that Joe Biden is not what people are supporting. People are supporting the removal of Donald Trump, right? And if we allow the Democrats to take that energy and consolidate it and channel it back into the state, what we end up with is we end up with a Biden presidency which feels like it has license to enact its own program, which is not what most people in the United States want. But if we are able to control the initiative, if we are able to prevent that consolidation of power, if we are able to continue to articulate that just because Biden is in office does not give him a mandate to enact his program, we could actually start to see the beginnings of a very significant shift in American politics. Because one of the things that has characterized American politics for decades has been the fact that Americans are deeply removed from what happens politically. That we sort of show up once every maybe 4 years with kind of partial information and throw a ballot in a ballot box, maybe, and then call it a day. Very few of us are out there every day really organizing all the time. That is changing, though. And in a situation like this, we are watching a moment in history in which if people are successful, they will be functionally saying that we are the ones that are in control of the situation. And if we lose control of that situation, it will only be because we give it away. That is the one thing that we absolutely cannot allow to happen. That regardless of whether Joe Biden is allowed to be inaugurated president of the United States, what we have to make sure of is that as people who are putting ourselves at risk, as people who have been for a long time fighting for a world that is different and more empowering, that we don't allow things to stop at Joe Biden getting inaugurated president, that we recognize that at the point in which we are able to resist anything that Trump would try to do to steal the election, to invalidate the electoral process, at the point where we are able to functionally resist that and win, that the people on the street have taken control. And at that point, there is nothing that will require us to give that power back, whether or not Joe Biden gets inaugurated into the White House. This historical moment will hinge largely on how much people are willing to recognize that.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.